From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
If you're going to take this holier-than-thou attitude, that your whole approach to immigration was so...
Immigration is not holier-than-thou, Mayor.
If you're going to take this holier-than-thou attitude, that you were perfect on immigration...
I'm not perfect.
If this so happens, you have a special immigration problem that nobody else here has. You were employing illegal immigrants.
You know,
That is a pretty serious thing. They were under your nose.
Rudolph Giuliani and Mitt Romney clashing over immigration at Wednesday night's Republican debate. We'll play excerpts. Then two Nobel Peace Prize laureates call for all charges to be dropped against eight former Black Panthers arrested earlier this year on charges related to the 1971 killing of a San Francisco police officer. The men say they made false confessions after New Orleans police tortured them.
They beat me, they punched me, they kicked me, they spit on me. They called me a lot of vile names. And then they told me that they was going to kill me if I didn't cooperate with them.
But first, tens of thousands of Venezuelans marched through Caracas to oppose a series of constitutional changes proposed by President Hugo Chavez. Is the CIA fomenting unrest to challenge the referendum? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Pakistan, President Pervez Musharraf has vowed to lift a state of emergency on December 16th. Musharraf made the pledge as he was sworn into a new five-year presidential term one day after stepping down as military chief. Under the emergency rule, Musharraf has purged the Supreme Court, arrested thousands of opponents, and censored critical media. Former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif welcomed the announced date, but said opposition will continue.
Our struggle is for the restoration of the judiciary. Our struggle is for the release of all the prisoners. Our struggle is for a level playing field for everybody.
Sharif and another former prime minister, Benazir Bhutto, are registered to run against Musharraf in January, but say they may boycott the vote. Meanwhile, at the White House, Press Secretary Dana Perino praised Musharraf for announcing a date to lift emergency rule.
We are not going to judge the date of lifting the emergency order. The president has said that it should be lifted as quickly as possible, as soon as possible. President Musharraf has indicated that December 16th would be the date, and we hope that he follows through on that.
President Bush is warning the Pentagon may soon begin issuing layoff notices unless Democrats drop a withdrawal deadline from a war funding bill. The White House has refused to accept a Democratic measure providing $50 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but setting a non-binding goal for withdrawing combat troops from Iraq by next year. On Thursday, Bush said he would reject any war funding conditioned on withdrawing troops.
Let us tell Afghans and Iraqis that we will stand with them as they take the fight to our common enemies. Let us tell our men and women in uniform that we will give them what they need to succeed in their missions, without strings and without delay. I ask Congress to provide this essential funding to our troops before the members leave on their Christmas vacation.
The House passed its version of the bill earlier this month. Republicans have blocked a similar measure in the Senate. The legislation also requires the CIA follow the Army manual ban on waterboarding during interrogations. Meanwhile, in Iraq, dozens of lawmakers walked out of parliament this week over their treatment at the hands of U.S. soldiers. The lawmakers say they routinely endure aggressive and humiliating searches in Baghdad's Green Zone. As many as 100 lawmakers took part in the protests. In the Philippines, nearly 100 military officers and their supporters have been arrested in a failed mutiny against the president, Gloria Arroyo. At least one quarter of the soldiers had fled their trial for initial coup attempt in 2003. Arroyo's popularity has waned amidst allegations of corruption and human rights abuses. Dissident General Danilo Lim defended the mutiny.
Dissent without action is consent. What we did was in consonance with our solemn constitutional mandate to be the protector of the people and the state.
Earlier today, thousands of people took to the streets of Manila supporting the mutineers' demands for Arroyo's resignation. The march comes on the Philippine national holiday honoring the anti-colonial resistance figure Andres Bonifacio. In Venezuela, tens of thousands of protesters marched through Caracas Thursday to oppose a series of constitutional changes proposed by President Hugo Chavez. Venezuelans will vote on 69 measures, including eliminating presidential term limits, creating forms of communal property, and cutting the workday from 8 hours to 6. Thursday's demonstration was the biggest show of opposition to the constitutional overhaul so far.
This Sunday, we're going to give President Chavez a definitive no so he doesn't continue violating all of our rights and remaining in power, which is his only interest.
Most surveys say the outcome of the Sunday vote is too close to call. Chavez plans to lead rallies in favor of the reforms later today. We'll have more on Venezuela after headlines. Back in the United States, the Bush administration has been ordered to release all information on lobbying attempts from the nation's major telecom companies to protect from prosecution over their involvement in domestic spying. The district court ruling came in a case brought by the Electronic Frontier Foundation against AT&T. It's one of several firms accused of illegally handing over customer communications without court warrants. In California, state lawmakers are considering legislation to regulate the predatory practices of the subprime mortgage market. Home foreclosures have skyrocketed under the growth of high-interest loans to low-income Americans. The proposed measures include creating a standard process for restructuring mortgages and banning higher-interest loans when recipients are eligible for lower ones. Some 200,000 homes are expected to go into foreclosure in California next year. And in Milwaukee, three former police officers have been sentenced to prison terms for the October 2004 beating of a biracial man. The victim, Frank Jude, was nearly killed when a group of off-duty police officers, all of them white, beat him at a party. Jude was repeatedly punched and kicked in the head and body. His fingers were pulled back, a knife put to his neck and arm and anus. His pants were cut off and objects jammed into both ears. An emergency room doctor who treated Jude testified he had the worst ear injury she had seen in 15 years of practice. On Thursday, three officers were given sentences of at least 15 years. An all-white jury initially acquitted the three officers and another officer of most state charges in April of 2006. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. In Venezuela, tens of thousands of protesters marched through the capital city of Caracas Thursday to oppose a series of constitutional changes proposed by President Hugo Chavez. The referendum is coming to a vote on Sunday. Chavez plans to lead rallies in favor of the reforms today. Venezuelans will vote on 69 proposed changes to the nation's constitution that include eliminating presidential term limits, creating forms of communal property, and cutting the workday from 8 hours to 6. Thursday's demonstration was the biggest show of opposition to the constitutional overhaul so far. On Wednesday, hundreds of students clashed with police and the Venezuelan National Guard. Most surveys say the outcome of the December 2nd vote is too close to call.
This week, President Chavez claimed the U.S. government is fomenting unrest to challenge the referendum. His foreign minister went on television late Wednesday, revealing what he said was a CIA plan to secure a no victory. The confidential memo was reportedly sent from the U.S. Embassy in Caracas and addressed to the Director of Central Intelligence, Michael Hayden. James Petras is a former professor of sociology and Latin American studies at Binghamton University. He is author of a number of books, including Social Movements and State Power. His exclusive article on Counterpunch is called CIA Venezuela Destabilization Memo Surfaces. Professor Petras joins us now from Binghamton, New York. Welcome, Professor Petras. Can you start off by talking about what exactly this memo is? Have you actually seen it? What is it reported to say?
Well, I picked it up off the Venezuelan government program. It describes in some detail what the strategy of the U.S. Embassy has been, and most likely the author, Michael Middleton Steer, who's listed as U.S. Embassy, may be a CIA operative because he sends the report to Michael Hayden, the director of the CIA. Now, what the memo talks about essentially is the, first of all, the effectiveness of their campaign against the constitutional amendments. And it concedes that the amendment will be approved, but it does mention the fact that they've reduced the margin of victory by 6 percentage points. The second part is more interesting. It actually mentions the fact that the U.S. strategy is what they call a pincer operation. That's the name of the document itself. It's pincer is tenaza, and it's first of all to try to undermine the electoral process, the vote itself, and then secondly, once the vote goes through, if they are not able to stop the vote, is to engage in a massive campaign calling fraud and rejecting the outcome that comes from the election. So on the one hand, they're calling a no vote, and on the other hand, they're denouncing the outcome if they lose. Now, the other part that's interesting about this document is what it outlines as the immediate tasks in the last phase. And that includes getting people out in the street, particularly the students. And interestingly enough, there is a mixture here of extreme rightists and some social Democrats and even some ex-Maoists and Trotskyists. So they mentioned Red Flag, Bandera Roja, and praised them actually for their street fighting ability in causing attacks on public institutions like the Electoral Tribunal. But more interestingly is their efforts to intensify their contacts with military officers, and what they seem to have on their agenda is to try to seize either a territorial base or an institutional base around which to rally discontented citizens and call on the military, and particularly mentions the National Guard to rally in overthrowing the referendum outcome and the government. So this does include a section on a military uprising, and it complains about the fact that that the groups under its umbrella or its partners are not all unified on this strategy, and some have abandoned the umbrella operation. And secondly, that the government intelligence has discovered some of their storage warehouses of armaments and have even picked up some of their operatives. And they hope in this that this is not going to upset their plans.
Well, James Petras, this is obviously a very explosive memo coming just a few days before the actual referendum. And while it certainly sounds like many of the types of tactics that the CIA has used in prior international adventures, has there been any confirmation whether this memo is...
obviously, it's... It's a memo that the U.S. will denounce. They always have this clause in their operation that they should be able to have an out. Secondly, the Venezuelans are very tolerant of their opposition. The Chavez government has not expelled the operative here, Michael Middleton Steer. There have been discussions I've gotten from my sources in Venezuela in the Foreign Office to expel this official, but they haven't actually taken that step. And it goes along with this very libertarian outlook in Venezuelan government. You know, many of the people involved in the overthrow of the president, the military takeover for 48 hours in 2002, many of them never were put on trial and never arrested, and they're back in action in this referendum. So law enforcement regarding what would normally be called insurrectionary activity in the United States, many of these people would have been locked in Fort Leavenworth and the key thrown away. In Venezuela, the golpistas, the people involved in coup planning and operations, are having a second, third chance.
Let me ask you, in this country, the main focus has been, obviously, in the corporate media on the attempt to do away with term limits for the president. But this is a very extensive, a major reform of Venezuela's laws or its constitution. Could you talk about the various other reforms that are involved in this vote on Sunday?
Yes, one of them, and probably one that's going to turn out the biggest votes for Chavez, is the universal Social Security coverage for many of the street vendors, domestic servants, other people that are in the so-called informal sector, which covers up to 40% of the labor force. So this 40% of the labor force will be covered now by universal Social Security coverage. The second thing is the 36-hour work week. The third is the devolution of community funds directly to local neighborhood organizations and what they call communal councils, which incorporate several neighborhood councils. They will be directly funded by the federal government instead of the money going through municipal and state governors, where a lot of it is skimmed off the top. So there's another very positive factor. It also will facilitate the government's ability to expropriate property, especially large areas in the countryside that are now fallow, and where you have hundreds of thousands of landless agricultural and small farmers. So it's a way of facilitating social change. It also stipulates that the economy will continue to be a mixed economy with private, public-private associations, partnerships, as well as cooperative property. The cooperative property is largely an employment absorption sector. It doesn't contribute that much to the GNP, but is seen as a way of absorbing the large numbers of people in the unemployment or low-paid sector. These are some of the major provisions. The government has argued with some effectiveness that in the parliamentary systems you have indefinite terms of office, and they mention in case of England with Tony Blair being reelected as many times as he wanted, they could have cited the President Howard of Australia, who was elected innumerable times. And they cite the Japanese Liberal Democratic Party, which has been in power for the last 50 years with different prime ministers, but at least an organization with enormous capacity to be reelected. So they don't see this as a they don't describe this as an unusual happening, much more like a parliamentary system rather than a presidential system.
But let me ask you, are there also some protections or new sections of the Constitution dealing with racial minorities and also with gender orientation?
There is guarantees, constitutional guarantees for women and homosexuals and especially Afro-Venezuelans. Of course, Chavez himself is part Indian, part African and part white. So essentially, Chavez has made racial equality not only legally but in substance a major point on his agenda. And I would say in my visits and conversations, even among his middle and upper middle class opponents, there is definitely a factor here of race. This is going to be a not only a class polarized referendum, but the race issue is prominent, and the right has emphasized the fact that in a very hostile way that Chavez is of African descent, and they have in the past put caricatures on their in their publications depicting him as a gorilla. And when Mugabe of Africa, president, visited, they had Chavez and Mugabe walking as if they were two gorillas. And this is national newspaper. This isn't simply yellow sheet publications.
James Petras, we have to break, but we're going to come back to this discussion. Professor James Petras is a professor emeritus of sociology and Latin American studies at Binghamton University in New York. We're talking about Venezuela. We'll also talk about the latest in Bolivia and Chavez negotiating with the rebels in Colombia and Uribe, the Colombian president, cutting that off. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Racehorse by Kirkland Dub Consortium here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Professor Emeritus James Petras, taught at Binghamton University Latin American Studies in New York, talking about what's happening now in Latin America, particularly focusing on Venezuela. Juan?
Professor Petras, I'd like to ask you, you're a longtime respected observer of the developments in Latin America and the left in Latin America. And I have a question about this, the issue of the term limits. Many people who support Chavez are still worried about this attempt to eliminate term limits and create a possible lifetime presidency, in that it seems to once again focus on the individual rather than on building the kinds of organizations and structures that can, in essence, change a society, transform a society. The emphasis on the cult of the individual as opposed to building organizations and political parties that will carry on after that leader has gone. Your response to that?
Well, President Chavez has been very supportive of local organizations. I mentioned these community-based, neighborhood-based organizations. He's also launched a political party, not a single party state, but a party, the Party of Venezuelan Socialist Unity. And so he's making big attempts to institutionalize the basis of his policies, and he's encouraged new trade unions and also peasant organizations. One of the serious problems is that when Chavez's popularity rose, a great many individuals, politicians, jumped on the bandwagon from a very diverse backgrounds, from conservatives to Christian Democrats, social Democrats, Marxists, etc. And this has been a problem for two reasons. One, it has eroded internal coherence in their ability to carry through and implement some of the policies that they've passed. And second of all, there is a great many people with a career of corruption that have entered into the Chavista movement, particularly in administrative posts. And Chavez is very aware of this, and he's aware of the hostility of many of his rank-and-file supporters to many of the especially elected officials in the municipal and even state government. So he's assumed political leadership with the support of his mass base in order to counteract some of these internal problems that they have. And it may have unfavorable consequences in the future, but in the short run, it allows for at least some resonance in the executive branch with popular aspirations. And this is a very hot issue now because the government, not exactly Chavez, but the ministers have not intervened to end the scarcity of some basic commodities. There's been a campaign by retailers and commercial outlets and distributors at hoarding and creating artificial scarcities, despite the fact the government is importing millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in foodstuffs. They're not getting onto the shelves.
Professor Petras, I wanted to ask quickly about Bolivia, the proposed constitutional changes there. On Wednesday, opposition groups staged a general strike in six of Bolivia's nine provinces against the government-backed changes. Bolivian President Evo Morales says the plans will give Bolivia's indigenous and poor communities a greater voice in running the country. The proposals will go before a national referendum in the coming months. This is President Morales speaking from the presidential palace in La Paz.
I hope that tomorrow morning these five governors are here to have a dialogue. I hope that in five or nine of our departments that we can lay down new social policies together for Bolivia, because this is a government for all Bolivians, not a government for just one sector of them, as some of our companions have said.
Professor Petras, Bolivia and Evo Morales, do you see similarities with what's happening in Venezuela?
No, because Morales has adopted a policy of conciliation with the elites, hoping that he could construct what he calls Indian capitalism, in which there'd be subsidiary benefits for the Indian communities, largely creating greater degrees of autonomy. But the autonomy issue has been taken up by the states, the right-wing states, and it's become a trampoline for a secessionist movement. I think these measures of autonomy have been reinterpreted by the extreme right, and they have assumed the leadership in five of the nine provinces, and they're heading for a major political and constitutional confrontation. And let us be absolutely clear what this is all about. The oil and gas wealth is precisely in the states that the right controls. And they are in favor of secession, in which they will control Bolivia's wealth, even though they may be less than the majority of the population. So this is just like in the United States, this is the equivalent of the Confederates, and they've been running roughshod in their states on opposition. Let me give you just one quick example. They have been assaulting the delegates to the Constitutional Convention. The government of Morales has not intervened with the military to protect these people. In fact, they're holed up now in a military school where they're carrying on their constitutional deliberations. And we've had other cases of assaults on Indian groups in Santa Cruz in Beni and other provinces that are associated with the secessionists. And it's both a racial issue, once again, as well as an oil and gas issue, and it's all hung around the issue of a secession, a white-dominated confederacy in which there will be no land reform, the wealth will continue to be shared between foreign corporations and the oligarchy.
James Petras, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor Emeritus of Sociology and Latin American Studies at Binghamton University.
Keep up your good work, Amy.
Thanks.
It's extremely helpful to all of us researchers and scholars and students of Latin American and world affairs.
Well, thank you for your work as well, Professor James Petras in Binghamton. As we turn now to the issue of immigration, Juan?
Yes, well, immigration was the key issue at Wednesday night's Republican debate hosted by CNN and YouTube. Republican presidential hopefuls sparred over sanctuary cities, driver's licenses, border security, and education. It was a contest to demonstrate who would be the toughest on illegal immigration. Even the most explicitly anti-immigrant candidate, Colorado Congressman Tom Tancredo, noted that the others were, quote, trying to out-Tancredo Tancredo. A question on sanctuary cities prompted a heated exchange between former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney and former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani.
This is Ernie Nardi from Dyker Heights in Brooklyn, New York, with a question for the ex-Mayor Giuliani. Under your administration, as well as others, New York City was operated as a sanctuary city, aiding and abetting illegal aliens. I would like to know, if you become president of the United States, will you continue to aid and abet the flight of illegal aliens into this country?
Mayor Giuliani?
Ernie, that was a very good question. And the reality is that New York City was not a sanctuary city. Single illegal immigrant that New York City could find that either committed a crime or was suspected of a crime. That was in the executive order originally done by Ed Koch, continued by David Dinkins, and then done by me. The reason for the confusion is there were three areas in which New York City made an exception. New York City allowed the children of illegal immigrants to go to school. If we didn't allow the children of illegal immigrants to go to school, we would have had 70,000 children on the streets at a time in which New York City was going through a massive crime wave, averaging 2,000 murders a year, 10,000 felonies a week. The other two exceptions related to care, emergency care in the hospital, and being able to report crimes. If we didn't allow illegals to report crimes, a lot of criminals would have gone free because they're the ones who had the information. But most important point is we reported thousands and thousands and thousands of names of illegal immigrants who committed crimes to the Immigration Service. They did not deport them. And what we did, the policies that we had, were necessary because the federal policies weren't working. The federal policies weren't working, stopping people coming in to the United States. If I were president of the United States, I could do something about that by deploying a fence, by deploying a virtual fence, by having a border stat system like my Comstat system that brought down crime in New York, and just stopping people from coming in, and then having a tamper-proof ID card.
Time. Governor Romney, was New York a sanctuary city?
Absolutely. It called itself a sanctuary city, and as a matter of fact, when the Welfare Reform Act that President Clinton brought forward said that they were going to end the sanctuary policy of New York City, the mayor actually brought a suit to maintain its sanctuary city status. And the idea that they reported any illegal alien that committed a crime, how about the fact that people who are here illegally are violating the law? They didn't report everybody they found that was here illegally. This just happens to be a difference between Mayor Giuliani and myself and probably others on the stage as well, which is we're going to have to recognize in this country that we welcome people here legally. But the mayor said, and I quote almost verbatim, which is if you happen to be in this country in an undocumented status, and that means you're here illegally, then we welcome you here. We want you here. We'll protect you here. That's the wrong attitude. Instead, we should say, if you're here illegally, you should not be here. We're not going to give you benefits other than those required by the law, like health care and education. And that's the course we're going to have to pursue.
It's unfortunate, but Mitt generally criticizes people in a situation in which he's had far the worst record. For example, in his case, there were six sanctuary cities. He did nothing about them. There was even a sanctuary mansion. At his own home, illegal immigrants were being employed. Not not being turned in to anybody or by anyone. And then when he deputized the police, he did it 2 weeks before he was going to leave office. And they never seemed to even catch the illegal immigrants who were working at his mansion. So I would say he had sanctuary mansion, not just sanctuary city.
All right. I got to allow Governor Romney just respond, and then we'll move on.
Mayor, you know better than that.
No, I...
Yeah, okay, then listen, all right? Then listen.
You did.
First of
you
all...
You did have illegal immigrants working at your mansion, didn't you?
No, I did not. So let's just talk about that. Are you suggesting, Mr. Mayor, because I think it's really kind of offensive, actually, to say, look, you know what? If you're a homeowner and you hire a company to come provide a service at your home, paint the home, put on the roof, if you hear someone that's working out there, not that you've employed, but that the company has. If you hear someone with a funny accent, you as a homeowner are supposed to go out there and say, I want to see your papers. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, what I'm suggesting is if you are going to...
If you're going to take
this holier-than-thou attitude that your whole approach to immigration was so
holier-than-thou, Mayor.
If you're going to take this holier-than-thou attitude that you were perfect on immigration.
I'm not perfect.
It just so happens you have a special immigration problem that nobody else here has. You were employing illegal immigrants.
You know, that is a
pretty serious thing. They were under your nose.
I asked the mayor again, are you suggesting, Mayor, that if you have a company that you hired to provide a service,
let us jump in here,
that you now are responsible for going out and checking the employees of that company, particularly those that might look different or don't have an accent like yours, and ask for their papers? I don't think that's America, number one. Number two, let me tell you what I did as governor. I said no to driver's licenses for illegals. I said, number two, we're going to make sure that those that come here don't get a tuition break in our schools, which I disagree with other folks on that one. Number three, I applied to have our state police enforce the immigration laws in May, 7 months before I was out of office. It took the federal government a long time to get the approvals, and we enforced the law, and Massachusetts is not a sanctuary state, and the policies of the mayor of pursuing a sanctuary nation or pursuing a sanctuary city are frankly wrong.
Mitt Romney versus Rudy Giuliani in the Republican presidential debate. The first question was around immigration. Juan?
Yes, it was amazing that this was the first question, and it began to dominate, obviously, the debates. These were actually also the most watched of all of the debates so far. About, I think, 4 million people watched them. And it sort of signals that immigration has become such a major domestic issue now in these debates. Interestingly enough, you have the two candidates who probably had the Republican candidates who probably had the most moderate immigration policies, each one trying to outdo it. The other on how anti-immigrant he has now become. It's the most amazing even for Rudy Giuliani to bring up the issue of Romney employing immigrant workers, undocumented immigrant workers, when his own police commissioner, Bernard Carrick, had to withdraw himself as a candidate for Homeland Security Chief when he admitted that he was employing undocumented workers in his household. And it just shows you once again that not only the Republicans, before the Democratic candidates, how you deal with the growing immigration problem in the country and how you deal with 12 million undocumented workers is going to become a huge issue in the coming campaign. And we're going to be able to have a little bit of a chance to expand on that next week, Amy, aren't we?
That's right. On Tuesday, we will be joined by Lou Dobbs on Democracy Now! For the hour. And if you have questions or comments that you'd like to share, you can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. When we come back, we're going to talk about the San Francisco Eight. We're going to talk with several former Black Panthers about a 30-year-old case. Stay with us.
Now we got a revolution, 'cause I see the face of things to come. Yeah, your constitution, well, my friend, it's gonna have to bend. I'm here to tell you about
Nina Simone singing Revolution. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 650 radio and television stations around the country. On Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, Nobel Peace Prize laureates Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Mairead McGuire are calling for all charges to be dropped against eight former Black Panthers arrested earlier this year for allegedly killing a San Francisco police officer over 35 years ago. In a statement being released today, Archbishop Tutu and McGuire said the charges against the San Francisco Eight should be dropped because the case is based in part on statements made under torture. They also criticized the FBI's COINTELPRO operations, which targeted the Black Panther Party. 10 months ago, police arrested and detained six former Black Panthers or supporters, Richard Brown, Richard O'Neill, Ray Boudreau, Henry Jones, Francisco Torres, and Harold Taylor. Two men already in jail, Herman Bell and Jaleel Muntakim, were also charged. The men were charged with the murder of Sergeant John Young in 1971 and conspiracy to commit murder for a string of attacks on other officers.
Harold Taylor and two other men were first charged with the murder of the police sergeant in 1975, but a judge tossed out the charges. Taylor and his two co-defendants said they made false confessions after police in New Orleans tortured them. Harold Turner and Ray Boudreau join us now in our Firehouse studio. Both were released on bail in September. We're also joined by Sophie Elijah. She is an attorney for the San Francisco Eight and deputy director of the Criminal Justice Institute at Harvard Law School. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Sophia, let's begin with you, the latest in this case.
Well, certainly the most victorious piece of news is that we were able to get the men released on bail in September. The bail reduction was very significant, particularly in light of the charges. Now, on December 3rd, this coming Monday, there will be a hearing in court to discuss several issues, including discovery issues, because the government has still failed to turn over all of the relevant discovery in the case. And another piece of news is that the appellate court in California has decided to hear the issue of the admissibility of the tortured confessions taken from Mr. Taylor back in 1973.
Tell us, Harold Taylor, what happened? What are you saying happened in 1973?
Well, in 1973 in New Orleans, myself and John Bowman and Reuben Scott was arrested in New Orleans by the police department. We were taken from the place where they arrested us and took us to the jail. And immediately when we got into jail, they'd start beating us. They never asked us any questions in the beginning. They just started beating us. They had already had Reuben. They had arrested Reuben earlier that day before they arrested me and John Bowman. And they put me in a room with Reuben Scott when they first got me there, and he had been there a couple of hours. Well, he was laying on the floor in a fetus position, and he had urine on him, feces, and his face was scratched up, and he was swollen, and he was trembling. And I asked him, I said, Reuben, what's going on? He says, nothing. He doesn't say anything. He's just shaking. And then immediately the door opens up and the police pull me out. And they tell me, says, if you don't cooperate, this is what you're going to get. And they made me take off my clothes, chain me to a chair, by my ankles to the bottom of the chair and my wrists to the sides of it. And I just had on my shorts. And at that point, they started beating me.
Now, let me ask you, at this point, they hadn't told you anything about why they had arrested you or what you were charged with or anything?
They never said anything. They never even charged me with anything. So they were beating me and asking me questions. When they started asking me questions, they started telling me about what I was supposed to have done, and that if I didn't cooperate and tell them what happened, that they was going to continue to do it. So they put plastic bags over my head and held me back while five or six police officers stood around me, hitting me and kicking at me. They were like kicking each other, trying to get their licks in. They were hitting each other, trying to hit me. And all I could do was sit there and just try to brace myself and anticipate blows coming. When they'd take the bag and put it back over my head, and they'd wait till I just about pass out, and they'd snatch it off. And at that point, One would stand behind me, and he would take the palms of his hands, and he'd slap my ears, and my ears would just be ringing. He did that a number of times, and fluid began to run down the side of my face, and I couldn't hear anything. It was just ringing. And at that point, they dragged me to another room, and they take me out of the chair, and they had a chains on my ankles, and they would drag me through like a gauntlet of police on both sides, and they were, like, kicking me and calling me names. And they continued that and put me in another room, and then I could hear John Bowman, and I could hear Reuben Scott, and they were hollering. They were doing basically the same thing to them that they were doing to me. This went on for, you lose conception of time, but it seems like it was forever. And they continued this and continued this, and then they said that they wanted to talk to me, they'd give me a break. They wouldn't give me water or anything like that. They'd leave me alone for maybe 5 to 10 minutes, and then they'd come back, and then they'd start asking me questions about the Black Panther Party, about police murders, different parts of the country. I tell them I don't understand what they're talking about. I didn't know. So they resume back to asking me questions concerning, well, what was I doing in New Orleans? When every time I got ready to try to explain why I was in New Orleans, they would continue to beat me, and I couldn't get anything out, say anything. And then this happened all day that Saturday. I think it was a Saturday. Sometimes I want to say it's Friday, but I lost track of time. And it happened so consistently that when they finally got a break, it would seem like it was about 2 or 3 in the morning, and they changed shifts, and the new shifts of police officers would come in, and they would start questioning me, and they would start beating me. New York Police Department came. To New Orleans. That early that morning, it was New York police there, and they were asking about Herman Bell. Did I know what Herman Bell was? I told them I didn't know what Herman Bell was, and I didn't know anything about what they were talking about. So it's murders in New York. Well, after that, they told me that Reuben Scott has implicated me in situations, and that if I didn't cooperate, that I was going to get more of the same. And I said, I don't know anything Reuben was talking about, but they continued to beat him. Then San Francisco came, San Francisco Police Department. They came in, and they took me in a room, and he says, Mr. Taylor, he says, we want to talk to you about San Francisco. I told him I had no idea what they were talking about. So they says, you know what, this is not California. This is a whole different show here. And I kept trying to tell him I didn't know. I said, can I use the phone? Can I call a lawyer or something? They told me, he says, you're not going to talk to a lawyer here. And they said, look, if you don't cooperate, I just have to open that door, and you know what's on the other side of that door. I kept telling them, I don't know what they're talking about. So the door flies open, 4 or 5 run in there. They start beating me and kicking me, and they just take me out of the room and just drag me down the hallway and take me and slam me back in a chair, chain me back up to the chair and start all over again with the plastic bag, the ear slapping, the slapjacks across the back of my shoulders, all down my legs and on my shins, between my knees. It was so painful that all you could do is try to scream, you know. Mm. And he says, you're going to talk or we're going to continue. This is going on as long as it takes for you to talk. And I kept telling them the same thing. So later, they did that all day. It went in shifts, and every time they took me back into the room with Ertelax and McCoy, those are the two detectives from San Francisco, Ertelax would play like he's there to... No, McCoy would act like he's there to help me, and Ertelax would stand there and browbeat me and try to intimidate me, and he was the one that would always threaten to open the door. If you don't talk, we open the door. And I remember a tape recorder being there, you know. I don't know when they turned it on or when they turned it off, but I remember one being there. And after that, they took me back out, and they didn't come back that day, the rest of that day. They just left me with the New Orleans Police Department. And my understanding is that it was a softening up period, that they was going to continue to beat me. No water, nothing to eat, in a bright room, in a holding cell, but the lights were real bright, and you just got your underwear on. And then they'd come in there with a hot blanket, real wet, real, real soaking wet. Not so much as scalding, like it would take your skin off, but it was hot enough to make it uncomfortable. And they throw it over my head, and one would pull my head back, and I'm trying to breathe, and I'm sucking in water from the blanket. And you feel like you're going to drown, you know? And so then after they did that for a while, they come back, and this is when I was introduced to the cattle prod. And that's when they told me, he says, you know what this is, you know? I said, no, I don't know what that is. Matter of fact, I could hardly talk from screaming so much that my voice was hoarse. And they started probing me with the cattle prod on the back of my ear, down the side of my arm, underneath my arm, all real sensitive areas. And they says, you know, we can do this all night long. We have nothing to do, you know. And this will continue until you talk to the people from San Francisco. So then after they left, they left me in the room again, so I'm sitting there. I can't move. I can't go to the toilet. I can't, you know, I've urinated all over myself from the electric shocks. And the door opened, and there's two New York police department, two New York detectives. They start asking me questions about a shooting of police officers in New York. And they said, you know what? He says, if you don't want to cooperate with us, we're not going to come back and stop anything. You know, and it went on for a while, and then they opened the door on me. And police came back in from New Orleans. The police department did the dirty work. All the detectives from out of town just basically asked questions. And when you didn't cooperate, they would open the door, and the New Orleans police department would come in. Well, that time, they took me from one room to a big assembly room, like a big detective room, where there's a number of different desks. And I think it was maybe about 12 o'clock. It was late at night, real late, because it was quiet, and there was no secretaries, nothing in this office. And one would hit me from behind my neck, and I would feel myself going unconscious. And before I hit the floor, they would start kicking and stomping me. I think I must have been unconscious two or three times because they would kick me to sleep and kick me back awake. And when I wake up, I'm being kicked. But I remember laying in a fetus position the whole time, just trying to get balled up tight enough to keep my head up. But I was chained up, so I couldn't get my hands over my head. But I could ball up as tight as I could. And they did that all day, all night, put me in a cell that night, and I thought I was going to get some sleep. They never took the chains off me then. I laid on a steel bed, the chains on my ankles and chains around my waist. And I laid there till maybe 4 hours thinking I'm going to get some sleep. But every time you hear keys, you jump. You know, you're waiting for it to happen again. And they come in. And when they come, they don't walk up to the door. They open the door, and then they just rush in and grab you. And, you know, you're so scared, you know. You know, they tell you over and over that they're going to kill you. And that was Sunday. They did that. And Sunday night, they told me, he says, you know, if you go to the courtroom, you know, there's nothing going to stop this. If you say anything in the courtroom, we'll bring you back. They're not going to let you go into the custody of the sheriff departments in St. Bernard Parish, New Orleans Parish Sheriff Department, because of the old prison there was Old Parish Prison, which is built back in the 1800s. And he says a lot of escapes and stuff, and they can make an excuse to keep me there. So I better do what they say or that, because I'm not going to be turned over to the sheriff department. So me and John Bowman, they didn't take us to court with everybody else. We heard them taking prisoners out of court for arraignment the next morning. And I'm anticipating that they have to arraign me because they arrested me. And, you know, 72 hours is up. You know, you got to take me to court that Monday. And they just kept us there.
I wanted to bring Ray Boudreau into
that. I'm sorry.
No.
I'm sorry.
I think it was very powerful testimony that you just offered. And unfortunately, we just have a few minutes. Ray, where were you at this time?
I was in New Orleans with Harold and the rest of the guys. But at some point, we observed that the police were trailing us and watching us. And I told everybody, I was living in Atlanta at the time. And I told everybody, I'm leaving the next day. And so, fortunately, I missed the arrest and all of the things that happened in New Orleans. And I didn't find out about what happened to Harold until later on, of course.
You did not experience any of what happened to Harold?
Oh, no. Not in New Orleans, no.
And then eventually a state court threw out your arrest on these charges because of the torturing?
Right.
And now, 35 years later, you get a new federal indictment on this case.
State indictment.
Oh, a new state indictment on this case. What was your reaction when you learned that 35 years later they were coming back on the same on the same accusations?
Well, you know, it was really funny to me because it was the day of 9/11 that really shook me. I was working at Tyndall Air Force Base, you know. I had the clearance to work on the flight line side. And after 9/11, I was sitting up getting ready to go to work. You know, I just lived five miles from the Air Force Base, so I was sitting up having a cup of coffee, and I just happened to look up and see one tower on fire. I said, wow, how are they going to get up there and put that out, you know? I didn't know an airplane had hit it. And while I was sitting there watching it and listening, I see this other airplane, and it comes into the tower, and I said, wow, it's bad. I said, it's old and new now. Anybody who's ever said anything, or been a participant of any progressive group during the COINTELPRO era, they're coming back at everybody. I think John Bowman, he's deceased now, he called me. He says, what do you think? I said, I think the chickens have come home to roost. And he says, well, you better get ready. He says, because they're going to come knocking on doors. And I don't think it was a year later that they start asking people questions. And they were asking me questions like, we just want you to look at pictures of white people and identify these white people. We're not interested in you. And then all of a sudden, they throw this Ingleside thing on me. Well, what do you know about Ingleside? Look at these other pictures. First, they had a folder with just all white people on it. Then after that, I said, well, I don't know these people. They flipped the page, and it's all black people. He says, do you know any of these people? I says, well, yeah, that's Ray Boudreau. You know, I know him. That's John Bowman, and this is me right here. You know, and that's where that went.
We're going to have to leave it there. Tonight, you're here in New York. You and from Panama City. You're here from Los Angeles. You from Boston, Sophia, at the Martin Luther King Labor Center on 43rd Street between 8th and 9th in New York City. You'll be there at 7 for an evening where you'll be talking. And the court date is December 3rd. And we will follow that story in San Francisco. I want to thank you all for being with us. And that does it for our broadcast. You can check out our new website at democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mike Castleman and Jeremy Seitz and Karen Renucci and the whole dedicated staff at Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.